Okay, we've turned the recorder on. We normally preface it by saying today is September 13th, 2010. I'm Randall Dodd with the Commission and Steve Metz with the Commission, and we're speaking with Professor Harry Markovits. Mr. Markovits, one of the things I wanted your opinion on, particularly as one of the fathers of modern financial economics, was some of your view of the particulars of where some of the quantitative modeling might have had flaws or errors in the crisis. And I thought if you'd like, maybe you want to give us your overview at first, and then we can go into a few particulars.
Yes. I'd like to distinguish between portfolio theory, as it's usually applied, and financial economics, as it's sometimes applied. As you perhaps know, portfolio theory worries about the risk and return on the portfolio as a whole. That is, typical use is by financial advisors whose client or 401k advisory services or even large institutional investors. But typically, the typical customer user is put into a 60-40 mix or 70-30 mix or something like that of stocks and bonds, but a little bit more sophisticated with different asset classes. And so they're not leveraged portfolios. They are the time horizon usually is they maybe re-optimize once a year or once every 2 years. They rebalance quarterly. They're very often for the financial advisors, the individual, sort of the small financial advisors, very often put their clients into ETFs or investment companies, whereas when large institutional investors do this, they'll sometimes seek money managers to outperform benchmarks. But you sort of think of it as a having an annual cycle or every 2 year reoptimization, quarterly rebalance, 60-40 or 70-30 mix or 50-50 depending on the client. So that's the typical use of portfolio theory. A lot of financial engineering sort of derives very often from either the Black-Scholes formula for option pricing or a variant of it. This has been used for constructing exotic instruments and hedging strategies and so on, sometimes with a considerable amount of leverage. And these have gotten into a lot of trouble, especially if they make an assumption that the returns, you know, in the short run, daily returns or weekly returns, are log normal. They're not. There are these black swans, but the black swans happen. My own measurements have been that the daily returns on the S&P 500, the ratio of the log of S&P 500 today to minus the log of S&P 500 yesterday, that's distributed like student distribution with between 4 and 5 degrees of freedom, which is quite susceptible to black swans, to outliers, to 10 standard deviation moves. But when you add up a whole bunch of them, 250 trading days worth of such moves, then that gets very much closer to normal, much less subject to black swan. So, for example, 2008 was a little short of a 2.5 standard deviation move. Now, you would expect if there was a so the S&P 500 for 2008 had something short of a 2.5 standard deviation move. So, two standard deviation or worse boost to the downside, you would expect let's say 2.5% of the time. So S&P 500's move was like a 1 year in 40 move, not a 1 year in 1,000 or something like that. Okay, so I should wrap up the.
Keep. Please, this is good.
Okay. I do want to make a strong distinction between mean variance analysis, or MVT, applied at the asset class level with a yearly or every other year rebalance, reoptimization, and a quarterly rebalancing. If you think of the people with a 60-40 mix, a typical, let's say, elderly client about to retire, they had, let's say, $600,000 worth of equity, $400,000 worth of bonds, let's say, split equally between corporate and government. This, in 2008, the $600,000 went down to $400,000. The $400,000 in bonds went, maybe stayed at $400,000. So their $1 million was now $800,000. That didn't make them happy. Maybe they have to work a couple of more years. But if they hung in the market, by now they would have recouped a substantial amount of that. As compared to somebody who was, had, quote, sophisticated, unquote, highly leveraged, financially engineered products who maybe got wiped out. So that's my basic overview.
Right. Well, I've been looking into some of the role of exotic derivatives in the crisis, and you're right. A lot of them are structured in one way or another as an option, and I'm sure that's priced against the model using Black-Scholes.
Right.
However, when I think of some of the structured products, it seems the model there is less Black-Scholes and instead something simpler. This Gaussian cupola seems to be a much simpler bit of quantitative analysis than,
right,
than Black-Scholes. It's not as straightforward and kind of elegant as the kind of mean variance analysis that goes into optimal portfolio weights. But I did want to ask you a little bit of your view about the Gaussian cupola. Would you prefer to start with an overview of that, or
I have read. I have no view. I've read that. I really don't understand what is fundamentally being assumed. I must confess that there's a lot of the finance literature that I just have not followed closely enough. My question, if you were an expert in Gaussian cupola, I would ask what is the assumption that you're making in the about daily moves, and is it consistent with 10 standard deviation moves, and anything which is model dependent, anything where there's model risk and leverage, I'm highly suspicious of.
Right. I think inherently it doesn't involve leverage in the same way Black-Scholes involves options with embedded leverage, but people did often take leveraged positions in the structured products, certainly.
Right.
One of the things that made me think it'd be interesting to hear your view on it, in that there is a little bit of common element, as I see it, in the mean variance portfolio analysis and the Gaussian cupola, and that they both rely on yours view relies on a sort of a constant variance covariance matrix, or a fixed degree of correlation amongst the assets and the returns on the assets in the portfolio.
Right. Once in a while, you touch on subjects where I do have opinions. Let's talk about. Let's talk about fixed correlations. It's sometimes said that when a crisis comes, all asset classes lose money. So that diversification has failed, and MPT has failed just when you needed it most. and now I have some views on that subject. You sound like you're quite well educated.
I have a PhD in economics from Columbia, and I've taught corporate finance for 10 years at graduate level, but I'm not an academic quite like yourself. I'm more of a policy person. I've focused my career here in Washington on trying to affect regulation and the laws regulating the markets, and so I don't have your anywhere comparable quantitative skills, but I try to understand this stuff.
Right. Okay. What I'm about to say is well within your capabilities. Let's talk about two related statements. One has to do with during crises, all asset classes lose money. Therefore, diversification isn't working. And the other one is that measured covariances during financial crises go up towards one. So let's first take that one about all asset classes lose money. And the easiest way to look at this is in terms of Bill Sharpe's one-factor model. There's a Sharpe simplified model of portfolio theory in 1963. So Bill says in that model, that model assumes that everything goes up and down together because they're all going up and down with the market or with some underlying factor. So the return on the ICE security is alpha sub I plus beta sub I times how well the underlying factor does plus U sub I, an idiosyncratic term. And the beta is not the capital asset pricing model beta, which is a regression against the market portfolio. It's just a regression.
It's a coefficient. Yeah, it's a linear coefficient.
It's not the cap M beta has to be a regression against a cap weighted, but this is just sort of a regression against some underlying factor. Okay, now. When a crisis involves is that underlying factor taking a big move to the downside and swamping the idiosyncratic risk. There's still idiosyncratic risk. Not everything goes in lockstep, but so everything does go in the same. You know, all the asset classes do go in the same direction, but not by the same amount. Like for example, the S&P 500 went down. Without dividends included, went down 38.5% in 2008. So that's by definition has beta of one. But the emerging markets have a higher beta, and they went down like 50% or more. Corporate bonds, they have a much lower beta. They went down a little bit, like 5% or something like that. So. Things went in the same direction, but not by the same amount, and roughly in proportion to their betas. There was some, there is idiosyncratic risk. So, if you were high on the frontier, if you were a mean variance investor and you were high on the frontier, and you had high beta asset classes, you would have gotten hammered. And if you were lower on the frontier, then you would got hammered less. So, that's all perfectly consistent with, ex ante having placed your bets. And in the long run, you'll do well, hopefully, if you're high in the frontier. But you are subject to these 1 in 40-year moves. So that's why everything moves in the same direction, because in that model, because... the systematic risk on some occasions ex post swamps the idiosyncratic risk. Now, if you look at the measured correlations, the day-to-day correlations, if you look at the formula for the correlation between two securities in Bill Sharpe's one-factor model, I have in mind what the actual formula is for the in the simplified case where you assume they both have a beta of one. Think of the correlation between two securities, let's suppose they both have the beta of 1 and they both have the same idiosyncratic risk. Then it turns out that the correlation is the variance of the market divided by the variance of the market plus the idiosyncratic variance, that they both have the same amount. So when the variance of the market is very high, like in a crisis, the market falls and everybody's worried they're going to miss the bottom, so the market rises and then it falls and it rises. When the variance of the market is high, then the measured, you know, ex post, the measured covariances, you know, go up. But, you know, ex ante, you have to place your bets sort of a, you know, on a forward-looking basis, assuming that maybe the market will go up and maybe the market will go down and so on. So that it's sort of an it is true that ex post, during crises, everything goes down, but more or less in proportion to their betas, and as you would expect.
Right. I mean, it doesn't deny that there's systematic risk.
Right. And and that ex ante, when you're picking off the efficient frontier, well, the efficient frontier doesn't necessarily assume that you have when you built your efficient frontier, you didn't necessarily use a factor model. You might have. We'll come back to the issue about do you have to use the same physics every year. You were talking about the constancy of an assumed constant covariance matrix. I'm having a problem with trying to talk about two subjects at the same time. Anyway, so rounding off the one about during crises, all during crises, all asset classes go down. If you had built your mean variance efficient frontier in advance using a factor model, you would have had to have made, let's say a one-factor model, you would have had to have made, when you did the estimate, some kind of estimate of the volatility of the underlying factor and the betas of each of the asset classes and the idiosyncratic, some estimate of the idiosyncratic risk of each of the asset classes. You would have put that into the optimizer, and the optimizer would have given you a frontier. And then if you were a young person, you know, with lots of years in front of you, maybe you picked someplace high in the frontier, which meant on the average over the long run you should do well if your estimates are right, but you could get clobbered when there's a big, you know, when there's a you know, big systematic risk. Whereas if you move lower in the frontier, but this business of, you had said something that that the use of mean variance assumes a constant correlation matrix or a constant covariance. If I remember your statement,
yes, sir.
That using the Gaussian cupola and the mean variance has a certain assumption about constancy of the covariance matrix.
They have what's called a common factor in the cupola, which allows you to basically take a multiple random variables and to compress it into a single random variable by having a constant common factor. And that's the elegance of trying to solve for the risk of a portfolio of N assets or a pool security of N assets computationally solvable way.
Right.
And that constant common factor is analogous, in my thinking, to your correlation in your mean variance analysis.
Right. It certainly is similar to that Bill Sharpe's one-factor analysis. They typically use this for, what's the time granularity? When they do this analysis, are they talking about?
Well, this is where they're pricing a pool security, particularly if it's structured from a credit point of view.
Right.
And so you're concerned.
Data returns, monthly returns?
I think these are just instantaneous returns in the sense that...
Even faster than daily returns.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is anytime you're trying to price with a model,
right.
Structured security, and you've got some knowledge of the returns of the underlying mortgages or whatever assets are in the pool, then this is the principal model you're using
right.
to try to come up with how to understand the interactions of the individual components in the pool
right.
to price your tranche.
Let's see. Am I speaking to Randall or to Steve?
At Randall.
Randall. Okay. I'll tell you, I once sat down and carefully read Black-Scholes, and then I went and learned some stochastic calculus and reread Black-Scholes, and that's about as much attention as I've paid to continuous time models. Obviously, you're going to talk to Bob Merton about continuous time models, but I just observe that that if you, as I say, there's a paper that I wrote that appeared in the Journal of Risk and Uncertainty called The Likelihood of Various Stock Market Hypotheses, which it was using a Bayesian analysis to shift beliefs among different probability distributions and parameters within the probability distribution. We're talking about the log of the ratio of S&P today to S&P yesterday. Noah Rossman, when I say we, I'm talking about Noah Rossman and myself. The system of probability distributions we use is the Pearson, the Carl Pearson family, which has lots and lots of special cases like normal and chi-square and student and types which are like type 4 that are have no name but are part of the system. So it's said that in terms of daily moves, you know what the base factor is, of course. In terms of the how much you should shift the belief, if you're a Bayesian, you should look at the likelihood of getting the observation given one hypothesis versus the likelihood of getting the observation given a different hypothesis. And when we did this for daily moves in the S&P 500, we found that you should move your posterior beliefs compared to your prior beliefs by a factor of like 10 to the 72, one followed by 72 zeros, the 10 to the 72 against Gaussian, against normal, in favor of student with these 4 to 5 degrees of freedom. So for daily moves, no way is it Gaussian. So if a Gaussian cupola in any way assumes something is Gaussian on an instantaneous basis, much less a daily basis, it has got lots and lots of model risk in it. But, if you take a student with at least 2 degrees of freedom, so that's got a variance, a student distribution, and you add together 20 or 30 or 40 of them, much less a year's worth of trading days worth of them, that gets to be awfully Gaussian looking. We don't have independence, but still it's close enough. So I have steered away from continuous time models. Von Merton and Myron Scholes got into a lot of trouble leveraging back. I never mention long-term capital management when I see Bob, a friend of mine. But I steered away from continuous time models. I think there's a lot of model risk involved in continuous time models, and when that's combined with leverage, I think it's a accident waiting to happen.
Okay, pardon me while I write slower than I listen.
Sure, I hit a hot spot, and you push the button, and all of a sudden I'm deluging you with my views.
Now, is the error with continuous time models to do with the frequency that you're using it to analyze?
Well, let's
like if you're trying to analyze a day-to-day or minute-to-minute problem as opposed to a 2 or 3 year portfolio optimization problem.
Sure. Let's compare daily with yearly. Okay. Suppose continuous time. I am sure if we extract you Randall are of course familiar with the central limit theorem,
mm-hmm.
which says you can take things which are very non-normal and average them together, do a little something so that the standard deviation does, normalize them. And it approaches normality, right?
Yep.
Okay. Now, my observations are that at the daily level, let's say it's a student with 5 degrees of freedom or 4 degrees of freedom, you can have 10 standard deviation moves out of a distribution like that. If you now compound the returns or add the logs, average the logs, so you get annual returns on 250 of those, that gets to be very much closer to normal. You're talking now about not daily moves that I've done the statistics. You're talking about, let's say, minute-to-minute trading, 5-minute to 5-minute trading. Now, it surely must be that the kurtosis of that, the non-normality of that, is much even worse than the daily moves. In other words, it's probably the hang on, let me just take a little sip of coffee here.
Yep.
It's probably true that the reason why, it could very well be true, that the reason why daily moves show great big blips relative to their standard deviation is because big moves have happened within a 5-minute, 10-minute interval. News announcement, all of a sudden something's terrible, and bang, you've got a big move. So that if you look now at, let's say, 5-minute intervals, that the kurtosis on that is even more non-normal than the daily moves that we observe, and of course, a fortiori, the annual moves. So I think these questions of fat tails, and incidentally, the 2008. Was that an outlier? No, it wasn't even the worst year. It was tied for the second worst year. So of the 80 or some years that Ibbotson has been keeping track of, from 1926 to the present, there's three. 2008 was, as they say, tied for the second worst year, and there was a worst year. So it was one of three out of 80 that were, but they weren't outliers. They were the curve. If you look at Ibbotson has this Morningstar now has this SBBI, stocks, bonds, bills, and inflation. And in there you'll find a histogram. Somewhere in there you'll find a histogram of annual returns on the large cap. I can think of mostly S&P 500, I imagine. And if you do a careful analysis, you can probably reject the hypothesis as normal, but it sort of looks like sort of normal. Whereas if you get down to daily moves, they are very definitely not normal, with big outliers. And if you get down to smaller, you know, the world is not continuous. The world is continuous for the physicists, but not for the economists. But
yeah, our data is not continuous. Yeah.
Right, and we do not act. I have another specialty beside portfolio theory. That's asynchronous discrete event simulation. And, you know, of course, nowadays you're getting down to reaction times in the milliseconds. So I guess that's as close to, you know, since we only perceive in seconds and they do things in milliseconds in the computer, I guess that's close to continuous. But I'm sure
it's getting faster than that.
Yeah.
You see that tunnel they dug from New York to Chicago to knock 3 milliseconds off the latency time trading between the futures market and the stock market in New York?
I have a friend who says he's a long-term investor. He holds positions for 4 or 5 days.
Exactly.
He says he's perfectly happy with the fact that now, if you go, you know, right now the bid and the ask may be a penny apart.
Yep.
Means he's got a very liquid market, so he's perfectly happy with this. I sort of been around. Do you want to focus?
I didn't want to sort of. I think we've talked a bit about the issue of whether and when the assumption of normal is appropriate or not in the quantitative analysis, and when that assumption might break down or be inconsistent with the actual outcomes.
Right.
I thought we'd also talk a little bit about also the assumption of constancy of the distribution or mean variance measure of it. For example, with focus just for a minute on the what we saw with some of the structured credit products. They were priced on the assumption of a certain degree of independence or lack of correlation between
right.
the underlying assets. And,
right.
and clearly what happened over time was that that tightened up. And so whether that tightened within the bounds of what might be fairly described as a long-run normal, it nevertheless tightened up so much that it made the original pricing of those
right.
tranches look like they were flawed.
Right. Randall, write down the following. I recited this before, and write down V like variance sub M, like for market, divided by V sub M plus V sub I. So the variance. So this is the correlation between two asset classes or two securities in the one factor model. I use the one factor model because it's the easiest to analyze, and it gives you the right kind of answer. So the correlation between two securities or two asset classes, if they both have the same idiosyncratic risk and they both have a beta of 1, is the variance of the market divided by the variance of the market plus the variance of the idiosyncratic risk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what I was saying before was if you have a period of time where the variance of the market or the variance of the systematic risk goes up compared to the variance of the idiosyncratic term, then your correlations are going to approach 1.
Yep.
Okay. Now, it's not my assumption. I'm not working in continuous time, but it's not my assumption. We'll come back to, how mean variance estimates of correlations come about and so on. When you do it, let's say, if you do a mean variance analysis for the year, then the correlations that you're estimating, or the covariances you're trying to estimate, is for an annual draw, to what extent will, if this asset class goes up, will that asset class goes up? Okay, so it really hasn't gotten, it really is not an issue of what is the short run volatility. It doesn't have to do with the process. It has for big cap versus small cap versus high yield bonds and so on. An annual draw from the S&P 500, for an annual draw from a bushel basketful of these asset classes, what's an forward-looking estimate of the correlation between, or the covariance between? Okay, that's a different kind of problem than one that has to do with modeling the minute-to-minute. She'll pick up the other line.
Okay.
The minute-to-minute moves. So you should be talking to Bob Merton. I'm not happy to talk to you, but especially with this message about plain vanilla portfolio theory versus financial engineering models, which have to do with annual returns or maybe quarterly returns because there's rebalancing. That kind of a model versus ones which try to describe the continuous time process, and also the difference in the use of leverage, assuming Gaussian processes versus the 60-40 portfolios that the usual MPT participant engages in.
Right. No, I see. The purpose of the quantitative analysis between the portfolio and the structured product is clearly significantly different, both in terms of the frequency, but
also the assumption of normality and to what extent that assumption is critical. Let me recommend to you that you get a copy of my 1959 book and you look at page 121. And what you'll see there is a table which compares the value of a log utility function. I'm not talking about a log normal distribution, right? But one of the fundamental assumption I made in my 1959 book, and these fundamental assumptions are back in chapter 10, 11, 12, 13, but the fundamental assumption I made was that the individual should be a utility maximizer. He should maximize expected utility. But back in chapter 6, where I'm talking about return for the long run, I explained the role of a logarithmic utility function for the long run. And what I do in this table is I list various levels of return, like minus 0.4 for a 40% loss, minus 0.3, minus 0.2, dot, dot, dot. That's in column 1. The next column is the log of 1 plus return. So that shows you what a logarithmic utility function would say about a 40% loss, a 30% loss, dot, 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 a 40% gain, a 50% gain. Okay, so we got column 1 is return, column 2 is log of 1 plus return, column 3 is R minus 1/2 R squared, return minus 1/2 return squared, a quadratic.
Uh-huh.
And you will see that between a 30% loss and a 40% gain, the quadratic is almost identical to the utility function. And even from a 40% loss to a 50% gain, they're not that much different. So if you're talking
about... It's constant relative risk aversion, right?
Given a utility function, given a point on the utility function, then Pratt Arrow's risk aversion is the second derivative divided by the first derivative. Okay, minus that. For Neumann and Morgenstern convinced us that Bernoulli was right, we should be maximizing expected utility, and in particular, there's the logarithmic utility function. But my point is that if between a 30 or 40% loss and a 40 or 50% gain, there is very little difference between log of 1 plus return and r minus 1 half r squared, a quadratic. So no matter what the shape of the distribution is within those limits, it could have, you know, skewed to the right, skewed to the left, multiple modes, and so on and so forth. No matter what the shape, it can be as non-Gaussian as you could possibly imagine, as long as it's confined in that interval on the portfolio as a whole, not, you know, any particular security interval bust, but if the return on the portfolio as a whole is mostly between a 30% loss and a 40% gain, with maybe a, you know, occasional out, you know, beyond that, then the expected value of the product has to be very close to the expected value of the utility function. And the quadratic, the expected value of the quadratic is just a function of mean and variance. So that is not normal. You take my 1959 book, you look at the table of contents, you never see the word Gauss.
Uh-huh.
There's no assumption of normality. The basic assumption is that the returns on the portfolio as a whole are confined to an interval in which a quadratic approximation to return is close to utility. And then, that's what was proposed in Marquis 1959. When I was at Hebrew University in the 60s or 70s, somebody said, well, why do you believe in mean variance? There's no normality. So I told them about this quadratic approximation. They said, okay, let's test Harry. Let's see if you know the mean and variance, can you guess expected utility? So there's a paper by Markowitz, Levy and Markowitz, Chaim Levy and Harry Markowitz, American Economic Review, 1979, which tries lots of portfolios of investment companies at the time, the returns on their portfolios, and various utility functions, and sure enough, if you know the mean invariance, you can guess the expected utility for all sorts of utility functions, even though if you do some statistical tests, you find that those return distributions are not normal. So that's my basic assumption.
Mm-hmm. I hadn't thought of that before. Of course, it nicely extends the reach of the portfolio theory's utility or usefulness.
Right. I'm preparing a talk for my best client called. Preparing a talk which I'll give in Dallas later this month, called Portfolio Theory in a Non-Normal World. Would you like a set of briefing charts?
I'd love to see that.
Okay, how do I email you?
Sure, it's rdodd, R-D-O-D-D,
right,
at fcic.gov.
You're no relation to Grayman Dodd, are you?
No, nor to the Senator Dodd.
.gov. R-D-O-D-D at fcic.gov. I'm supposed to have this to him by the 15th, and I'll send you a copy of.
Did you go to Baruch College after Hebrew University?
My degree is from the University of Chicago. I just visited Hebrew University for 9 weeks when I was working at IBM.
Oh, I see.
And I went to Baruch College after, I worked at IBM Research for about 9 years. And then I went to Baruch College for about 9 or 10 years, ending in 1993. And then I came out to California.
Okay, we were there at the same time at Baruch. I was there from like 85 to 88, but I was adjunct.
Uh-huh.
While I was in grad school up at Columbia.
Oh, and
I was teaching corporate finance there at the college.
But up at Columbia, did you say? Or?
Yeah, I went to my PhD was there, but I was teaching as adjunct.
On 26th Street?
By Madison Park.
Yeah. Oh, no, you were Madison Park. I was at, well, that's right. I was on Park Avenue. Madison was a block over.
Yeah.
I was at 26th and Park. Right, that's where I taught.
Yeah, I think we must have been on this, at one point walking in the same halls. That's fun. but I just kind of shot in and out because I was adjunct. I think they only had temporary offices for me. But I just had to ask that because I saw Baruch
pop up. Were you in the finance department? Oh, that's right. Economics and finance was what? Econ and finance.
Yeah, that's how I remember it. Yeah.
That's right. And so I think we had the sixth floor or something like that. Even if you were my next door neighbor, I would have forgotten your face and your name by now. My memory is horrible.
Well, I was at the time I was focused on other things than appropriately meeting all my colleagues there. I just well, I'm trying to think of what question to ask next. I think I understand after teaching it for years. I know portfolio theory better than I did this morning. But I was trying to. You did mention some of your concerns with continuous time analysis, you were concerned about how inapplicable the assumption of normality was over a short time horizon. Right. Were there other shortcomings with continuous time analysis that you think we need to be focused on?
I think one is let's take the Black-Scholes model. That assumes that the way that they get their the way they get their conclusion is they assume that you can the Black-Scholes model is a CAPM model in continuous time. Of the CAPM models, there's a certain breed of them which assumes that you can borrow all you want at the risk-free rate. There's another breed of them which assumes that the only constraint on the choice of the portfolio is the sum of the x is equal 1, and negative x's are interpreted as short positions. Okay, does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, it is not true that the sum of the x is equal 1 and negative x's are that is not a proper way to model short positions. So, for example, suppose that a portfolio which had minus 1,000 for security 1 and plus 1,001 for security 2, and everything else was 0, the sum of the x's would be 1. But Reg T does not allow you to put $1,000 at your broker, short $1 million worth of security 1, use the million plus the 1,000 to buy security 2. In fact, what it allows you to do is if you've got $1,000 at the broker, you can have the sum of your short positions plus the sum of the long positions equal 2,000, not a million and a thousand, something
right.
Like that. So the Black-Scholes model is one where the sum of the x is equal 1 is the constraint, and so there's an unrealism there. That's an extra little gripe that I have about CAPM models in general that make the assumption that some of the x is equal 1 is the only constraint. But there was one topic that we just briefly touched on, and let's go back. And I'd like to talk about the cycle, the estimation cycle for mean variance. Very often, let's suppose you make these estimates once a year or once every other year because you're using long-term, for the covariance basis, very often you just use very long-term statistics. there are certain adjustments that you have to make because not all time series are of equal length. Those adjustments are made. Usually, people inspect the correlation matrices to see whether they're plausible. If you had strong beliefs about how systematic risk is going to be different in the forthcoming year than in the past, let's save that thought for a minute. People, the investment committees that look at these things very often will adjust historical averages to be their own forward-looking expected return. So it is not required that you use historical average return as your estimate of forthcoming expected return. And a lot of debate goes on as to whether the equity premium will be as great in the future as it was in the past, considering the big rise in valuations that have happened since, let's say, 1926 to the present.
Yep.
So those are very often subjects to discussion and can be different one year from the next. If you wanted to horse around with the covariance matrix, you mustn't go in and just screw around with covariances, because you'll make the thing no longer a positive definite covariance matrix. But if you use a factor model like the Barra model or the Fahman French three factor model or Bill Sharpe's one factor model, you can, on a forward looking basis, decide that maybe this one has a little higher beta and this one has a little lower beta. Marshall Bloom says that the ones which had high betas, individual securities that had high betas in the past, usually don't have as high a beta in the future. They sort of regress toward the mean. But you could make your own forward-looking estimates of whether systematic risk is going to be more volatile, or idiosyncratic risk is going to be more volatile. In other words, this leisurely cycle where you really are carefully considering your estimates once a year, once every other year, these are supposed to be forward-looking estimates, and you're not required to have the same estimates every year. And they don't have to be history. They can be, as they say, forward-looking. This is different than if you have a continuous time process where you have some kind of a model that's going to guide your action continuously. Anyway, Randall, I will send you this this thing about the normality, and I think you sort of got my general position. I think, given your background, you could probably deduce my position on almost any other question in the kind of area that we're talking about.
Well, this is not the area where most of my academic work had been, so I'm a little not on my front leg here talking about this, but it just seems to me, when I look at some of the ways in which this plays out in the actual market conditions, both if you're looking at the way our optimal portfolio works, or if you look at the way the value of a credit-structured product works, is that you've got, if you're in day one of your kind of random walk and you're looking at the node of a normal distribution, then, you've got some relationship between all these different different assets in your portfolio or your security that may indeed behave like you think. But then something pushes you pretty far out. You get a 2-standard-deviation movement. And then out there, you no longer have the same correlations you had back when you were at the node of your distribution, and so that even if the individual securities were to continue to behave in a normal way over time, it seems the correlations don't.
And okay. Now, you're talking about daily or instantaneous or annual?
Well, this would be the time here would be, it could be even over the period of a year. So okay. Let's just think of our world from, let's say, March 2007 to March 2008. So we start seeing, and this is in a structured credit product world,
sure.
You start seeing a rise in serious delinquency rates on these subprime mortgages. So, okay, but we know they're not prime mortgages. So, initially it's a noticeable rise, but maybe it's only one standard deviation. But over the period of the next 12 months, you're up to two, maybe three standard deviations in the serious, not just delinquency, but the serious delinquency rates. And so... and then that invites higher correlation realizations to fall in. And so what you initially thought would be a pool of poor credits, and so you'd have a likelihood of more defaults, but they would be not too terribly correlated, these defaults. You know you got bad credit risks, but you think they kind of die in a random fashion. And now, due to several factors, probably not the least of which these are all variable rate mortgages, and interest rates have gone from 1% to 5.25%, you've got a strong common factor that's come into play. And so now, but you've assumed, that's not the common factor you've assumed in the original pricing model, but now your correlations have tightened up, so now you don't have that independence. So you've got all that. I'm sort of taking the portfolio theory here and applying it to this structured product. Now all that wonderful benefit of diversification that we thought we'd achieve through securitization seems to have withered or evaporated for us.
Right.
And what's really killed us hard here is that the way in which we price the different tranches, which is not something the portfolio theory is ever designed to apply to.
Right.
But now we are in this tranched world. And so now, holy moly, it's not just that our losses for the whole portfolio are, 10% instead of 4%, which might itself be within the maybe some normal distribution, but now the correlations are such that our original pricing different tranches seems terribly wrong.
Right.
And what we
okay.
Yeah.
Now, let's. I do have clients that I do have a client that I speak to every Monday. So I spoke to him this morning, who works on a weekly cycle. He does portfolios of closed-end funds. Okay, so let's, I just can't think in continuous time. You don't have time to think.
Yeah.
Let's talk about, suppose instead of being portfolios of closed-end funds, he had been portfolios of tranches. Now, suppose that was... his game. Now, mean variance analysis, as you said, does not do asset pricing. But suppose that the situation were... I'm having difficulty. Let me tell you what we do, and on a weekly basis. It's as close as in terms of my personal experience to the kinds of things you're talking about. Now, of course, every week he looks at the prices of closed-end funds every week. He has a computer program which is doing a mean variance analysis. It's tracing out an efficient frontier every week. Most of the time, the inputs to that mean variance analysis are sort of automatic. Most of the time, we do not stop and say, what's going wrong with this model? But we have, on occasion, said, what is going wrong with this model? And that's sort of the closest. And I'll tell you what we do regularly, and I can't make the instantaneous transition to portfolios of tranches, but I can tell you how it works, how it has worked with these portfolios of closed-end funds. First place, we have an expected return model, which assigns an expected return to this closed-end fund, depending on certain variables like the discount of the fund and the what the historical discount of this fund has been, which is another. What is this discount now? How does that compare with the discount which it normally has? What is the NAV alpha of this fund? So we have, so our expected returns are continuously changing. As a function mostly of what the discount is. So we're trying to pick up things with deeper discounts and sell them at less deep discounts. For covariances, we just use last 150 days. All this has been, way back when we started this in the late 1980s, we had back tested this very thoroughly, and now we've got like a decade or so of real experience with it. So we do a mean variance analysis using these expected returns that depend on discount. We do the mean variance analysis subject to various constraints. We have the All Country World Index, Morgan Stanley All Country World Index as our benchmark. We constrain the portfolio not to be too much invested over or too much invested under any region of the world, or any country in the world. We constrain its beta not to be too far, even U.S. beta. These are all things which are traded in New York or London, closed-end funds with emerging markets, different markets and so on, different countries. And we constrain the turnover of the portfolio, not too much. So this is a process which is dynamic. The estimates keep changing, but they keep changing by a certain decision rule. At one point in time, we found that we were getting into trouble, and we analyzed why, and we found that our underlying investment companies were making bets in certain industries which were having problems. So we put in sort of an industry exposure constraint for a couple of major industries. At a different time, we found that we needed a beta constraint. So so there was this process, and the process would sometimes stop working, and then we'd ask why, and then we'd change the process. So, but every weekend he gets these prices and does this optimization. So that's what we did in a mean variance world where we had no option pricing. We did have expected return. We did have a process which made expected return estimates, and we did have tight constraints on our exposures, and the processes worked just fine. Including through this, we did get clobbered in 2008. The last quarter of 2008, we fell like 5 or 6, 7% behind our benchmark, but we have since made that up. So that
that's as close to what I really do as what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, okay. Let me ask you just a more general question then, shifting a bit. Do you feel that the quants have been fairly or unfairly singled out as part of this crisis?
I think there's two guilty parties. The quants. I mean, there's a lot of there's a lot of other things going on, but one, I think the quants slicing and dicing and leveraging each stage and not really thinking through the direct and indirect consequences of what they're doing. You know, with you take a bunch of mortgages which are zero money down, they're infinitely leveraged already. You put them into a CMO, you add leverage, you slice it up, send maybe one of these tranches over to a CDS, which is adds leverage and slices it up and sends it around the world, and then you your credit default swap is the writing of insurance on correlated risks, and you just don't have enough reserves behind. So I think I think the quants are party one, guilty party one. The guilty party two is the Congress, who said to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the banks, "Thou shalt loan to certain areas, whether they can pay the loans or not." So I think in the year 2000, the head of Fannie Mae said, "We will by the." By the end of the decade, by a decade later, we will have $1 trillion out there of what we would not call subprime loans, low cost housing. So I think the combination of the feeding of the mill with low cost housing, mortgages on low cost housing, and then the slicing and dicing of those mortgages by the financial engineers, I think that's what's different about this. Different about this crisis.
Well, there certainly was a lot of financial innovation involved. Do you think it compares to what Milken was doing with CDOs back during the junk bond boom of the late 80s?
No, there's something different. Let's think about that. Now, that's an interesting question. So Milken said that, again, it's a matter of time scale. Milken said there are a lot of bonds which are, he did a PhD dissertation, I think, on this topic, and he found that there were bonds which were not investment grade, which on the average, if you made, if you selected them well and diversified among these, would on the average make you money. And he facilitated that. Of course, once somebody forgot to be too much of that, everybody wants to get into that act. There was the, there's all sorts of crises. The closer analogy would be, you remember portfolio insurance.
In 87, particularly.
1987, October 19th, 1987. Well, a date that will live in infamy. Financial engineers decided that they could do a synthetic call by shifting back and forth between stocks or futures in stocks, was it say stocks, and cash. And then they could create a synthetic call. And instead of having a relatively small market like you'd have at real calls, this way you could get
at the time there was $90 billion worth of portfolios, which was a big money in that day, following the portfolio insurance formula. During the week before Black Friday, and the problem is it's pro-cyclical, it's in which, you know, and I'm struggling for the word, not cyclical is not the word, but, you know, when the market went up, the more money got into it, which would tend to make the market go up more, and then if the market went down, money would come out, which may sort of destabilizing. And then what happened was in the Friday before Black Monday, the market went down 100 points, which at that level was a large move. And so the portfolio insurers had to sell, and the brokers of the portfolio insurers knew that they had to sell, they sold first, but the presidential report on what they call the market break calculated that the portfolio insurers should have sold about $10 billion worth of stocks or equivalent in futures, and by the time they'd sold $5 billion, the market was in shambles. So there was it was analogous that somehow portfolio insurers, financial engineers were involved. They were perfectly innocent in the sense they thought they were doing something good for their clients. But when you sort of saw through the direct and indirect effects of their actions, it turned out to be a one-day disaster. By the end of the year, you know, the market was back up. Unfortunately, with the current situation, when you see the workings out of the financial engineered products, it was more than a one-day disaster. It was a real disaster, a worldwide disaster.
Yeah, no, it was certainly had longer-lasting impacts than the '87 stock market crash, which. It really didn't even get us. I think the economic growth diminished slightly, but it wasn't anything.
Yeah, no. But again, it was financial engineers doing good things. The assumption that Leland O'Brien and Rubenstein made in working this out was that they had perfectly liquid markets. And of course, when everybody tried to sell, the market was not liquid. I don't know what the basic assumption. The financial engineers, you know, of these structured products, it may be normality was some of these products I think are such that there's various products around. I just don't know them well, but I think there are products around where if you have less than a 2 standard deviation or less than a 3 standard deviation, you make money, and if you have more than a 3 standard deviation money you get clobbered, and those more than 3 standard deviation moves just happen. So you know, the financial engineers I think were involved with the this latest one, this long-term capital manager. They were actually just using mean variance. But they were leveraged tremendously.
Yeah.
And then the Black Monday, they were doing calculations, assuming that you could get it in and out anytime you want, as if it was a continuous market. And so I think.
I guess what's also rational for one individual isn't rational if everyone does the exact same thing.
Right.
So
but on the other hand,
unintended hurting. You may not realize you're hurting, but you are.
Right, but
until you find out, some of the hurt emerges when you're all stampeding.
Right. You have read, haven't you, Extraordinary Popular Delusions of the Madness of Crowds?
I unfortunately lent that book to a friend.
Charles Mackay. You're talking about Mackay's book.
McKay?
I've heard it's Mackay, but who the heck knows?
Oh, you've got to read it. It's just the first 100 pages. Those
right.
Those economic insanity. Later they get into burning of witches and so on, and I just can't. And it's true, but I just don't want to read about it.
Every time you read about the South Sea Bubble or John Law, it very often comes from that book.
Right, absolutely. Well, during the late 1990s, my chiropractor would keep telling me about hot tips he got from customers of his and how much money he made on these hot tips. So I loaned it. I have in my credenza here, whatever it's called, this little bookcase behind me, closed bookcase, copies of Portfolio Theory, my Portfolio Theory, Portfolio Selection, I should say, copies of Extraordinary Popular Illusions, and also something by the Foundation of Statistics by Leonard J. Savage. So I have these copies of Extraordinary Popular Delusions, which I pass out like tracks, not quite that much, like people standing on the corner with the watchtower track. So I gave them a copy, let's say in 1999, and then by 2001, he was saying, oh, I read it, it was very interesting, I didn't pay any attention to it, and I really should have. So. Now, that was a different kind of situation where people were, these people in the big brokerage houses thought things were trash, but were pushing it because they were underwriters. Nobody was innocent. There were guilty parties. But here, you're not going to throw Bob Merton in jail. You're not even going to throw Barney Frank in jail. Even if he deserves it, he's not going to. So, from my point of view, it's the combination of thou shalt, redlining is just due to prejudice. You've got to make loans to these people, whether they can afford it or not. What are we going to do with this piece of paper? We've got to pool them and get rid of the risk. We can slice and dice and leverage. I mean, everybody's innocent, but the whole thing works out crappy.
Yeah.
That's Steve Metz, I hear.
Yeah, right. No, yes, Professor Markowitz, hi. We've actually spoken in the past. I worked on a book years ago, Beyond Wall Street, The Art of Investing.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And I worked on a few years ago, I wrote something else. So I'm glad to have the opportunity to speak with you again, and I won't hold you up very long. I just want to say you heard Randall's credentials, and of course we know yours. I provide the regression to the mean.
Let me point out something. Let me tell you something in terms of proposal. I wrote some time ago, I wrote these ideas out that got published in a financial analyst journal, I think that January of 1979. I don't know where my mind is. 2009, January 2009. I was approached by some folks, an old friend from IBM Research, or something called the Committee to Establish a Financial. I can't remember what it's called, but it did get itself. My job was to conscript some Nobel laureates and try to get something like it into the into the financial reform bill. There's something called an Office of Financial Research.
That's right.
And its function, if it works like we hope, its function is to, for standardized reporting among these derivative securities, so you can get them all in the same database, and then try to get a database of what people's exposures are, and keep it up, not just once, but keep it up regularly, And so that if somebody gets too big to fail, you can let the stockholders, you know, go down the drain, and the bondholders, if there's no equity, but be able to get in and understand what the direct and indirect exposures are. And, you know, so this is the, sort of the anniversary of Lehman Brothers. You can let the risk takers get the, you know, get the axe, but some still somehow be able to make the system work. There's this story they tell about J.P. Morgan, 1907 crises, and he got all the bankers in. He asked all the bankers to show him their statements. He got them all in a room, said, okay, we'll save you, we'll save you. You're too far gone, you're too far gone. We'll open up on Monday and everything will be okay. And everything was. Well, the world has become much too complicated for that now, maybe. But the hope is that if we get standardization and databases and analyses and be able to try to think through the direct and indirect exposures of things, we could let the risk takers suffer the consequences of their bad debt, but still, you know, sort of keep the, you know, project some confidence, you know, keep the system running and keep people confident. So that's my that's, you know, still my positive proposal is just to distinguish from just blaming my financial engineering colleagues for getting us screwed up. Anyway,
yeah, I'm sorry, Professor Marquez. I do actually want to ask you a quick question.
I wasn't trying to
with
you guys.
And I think
it sounded like we were winding down. But if you have more questions,
just very quickly, I think. And I think actually, you and Rand, you might have answered this already, but so much of what we saw in recent years was the virtue of these securities. It was touted on the basis of diversification. So there was some misunderstanding of diversification, and I wonder if that thought resonates with you.
Yes, let's go back to this Bill Sharpe's one-factor model. Okay, I don't know. If you've got it sort of firmly in mind, but you have a piece of paper in front of you.
I've got a piece of paper. Yeah, I'm not sure how how much I'll make of it, but go ahead.
Well, you know, put the R sub I, you know, so the return on the ICE security is alpha sub I plus beta sub I times F, that's some factor, plus U sub I. U sub I is the idiosyncratic term. Okay, now. When you did, so, okay, R sub I equals alpha sub I plus beta sub I times factor plus U sub I. Okay, now, what happens is when you diversify, in that world, and that's a sort of a simplified world, but it's sort of representative, in that world, if you get a lot of securities together, then the beta of the portfolio, let's say beta P, that approaches, the little arrow approaches, the average beta. So the beta of the portfolio is just the average of the betas of the individual securities.
Right.
That's exactly true for an equal weighted. Whereas the idiosyncratic risk of the portfolio approaches zero. In other words, we're assuming that these U sub I's are independent of each other. So as you diversify your portfolio, as you diversify your portfolio, this idiosyncratic risk goes away.
Right.
If you have a, you know, portfolio with even 50 or 60 securities, in this world, certainly by 100 securities, you sort of diversified away this idiosyncratic term.
Sure.
So the real riskiness of your portfolio is this beta, this average beta. So if some sell side broker calls you up and talks you into a high beta stock or asset class on the grounds that it's going to diversify your portfolio, what it's going to do is jack up the base of your portfolio, and you've probably got enough diversification in your idiosyncratic risk anyway. So if that doesn't pay for itself in terms of expected return, you should turn them down. Now, the world is more complicated than I make out, and there is, there is a certain amount of diversification between the U.S. and EU and or EFA and emerging markets. So I've done it. This analysis is a little bit extreme, but it's still sort of true. If what they marketed were high beta asset classes on the assumption that they're going to diversify your portfolio, and they use historical covariances, without taking into account that, presumably measured over some period of time when this asset class has been quite uncorrelated, when the underlying factor has been fairly tranquil, then they're going to sell you crap.
So, I thought where you were going is the virtues of diversification in portfolio theory that eventually erase that idiosyncratic risk. The opposite somehow happens when you're dealing with these high beta structured securities.
No. If I'm taking a very simple model of covariance. Obviously, if you put all your money directly and indirectly into high tech or into mortgages, and high tech bubble collapses or the mortgage market collapses, then obviously something is going on over and above this this simplified model. What I'm just saying is in the Bill Sharpe one-factor model, if somebody sells you something with a high beta, the fact that it's going to help diversify the idiosyncratic part is probably not that important. What's going to stick out when the market moves is this high beta. But if, the things that they were selling were not, since a lot of the products had a common factor, namely the mortgage market under them, they were selling something that had a source of systematic risk, which is a no-no, which portfolio theory says is going to hurt you, not help you.
Right. Well, that. All right. You just put it very succinctly for me, I think, to suggest why that I've been trying to put my arms around what was wrong with this notion of diversification, and I think you've just described it. So thank you.
So this business about I have two models in mind. Two mental pictures. One is a picture in which somebody, like once a year, what is the relevant covariance matrix? Are we investing in something where there's some new source of systematic risk? We can't use historical covariances, we don't have a long enough period. In other words, I'm thinking of a rational process. On the one hand, I'm thinking of a rational process in which people ask, on a forward-looking basis, are these things I'm investing in some source of systematic risk? On the other hand, I'm thinking of something where a broker calls an institutional investor and says, "I have," or he might maybe not even an institutional investor, just an individual investor, and just asserts this thing will diversify your portfolio for you. So, who believes brokers?
Well said. If we have any further questions, can I send you an email or give you a call?
That's just fine. I'm going to be in and out Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday, in and out. But I do pick up my emails and get replies to my secretary, and then I'll be back in on Friday, so you can email me or call me on
That's
Friday.
Great.
I have a very broken up schedule. That's why we did it through noon my time, which is no problem. I just brought in a sandwich. You're more than welcome to. And I'll. Do you have my email?
No, we don't have it. No.
Yeah, one of the things is people email me at UCSD, and I'm only on campus when I teach, and I don't bother to look at my email. But it's Harry. So it's harryhmm@aol.com.
Great.
And you did call me at this number, so you have this number.
Yep.
Okay, great.
So pleasure to talk to you.
My pleasure.
Thanks so much.
Very good question. Very interesting. Thank you much.
Okay, bye for now.
Bye. Good.
The best of the Nobels we've talked to, I think. I thought he was really trying hard to sort of think through it. And
yeah, no, that's my thought. And he's 83.
He's 83.
It's, you know, the fact that he can, you know, I can barely remember. His memory's better than mine. I hope I'm in his shape when I'm 83.
Yeah, my mom's doing mentally pretty well.
Yeah,
she's 83. She's exactly the same age.
Well, is your father living or not?
We just lost him about almost exactly 2 years ago.
Yeah,
and so I've been bringing her up here a lot. She likes the kid, and
you have a son, daughter, grandchild?
I have a 3.5-year-old, and so it really cheers her up to be around him. And he. For a 3-year-old, he kind of gets it. He's very good with her. Doesn't push back with her like he does me.
Kids and grandparents, great combination.
Yeah, yeah. And she's pretty good. Like him, she's always complaining about her memory. I go, Mom, everyone forgets things. You just don't remember that you used to forget things. You've always forgot things. It's a human condition. You don't seem to particularly really lose it at all. It's just you don't remember that you... the only thing you don't remember is that you used to forget.
I'm glad you... I've spoken to him really a couple of times, and not at great, great length, but I had the feeling that he was that kind of person. He does really give you the quality of his thinking when you talk to him.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is really great. And
yeah, Sharp was kind of... He was all right, but it just wasn't... He's kind of giving us a line the whole time.
Well, Sharp is, I don't think, believe it or not, I think Sharp and Markowitz to me are like two different generations in a way. I mean, you know, I don't know why that is, but Sharp, of course, has his business and he's selling and, you know, I think Markowitz has always been motivated by the thought.
Probably not always. He's been more of a private sector employee. Who's Rand?
Not what you would call a distinguished career for a guy who got a Nobel Prize.
He's unusual. He's PhD from Chicago, but
right.
His boss hasn't been hired by the top programs. I don't know why, but Brooklyn College is not the.
You think he could teach?
He wasn't in my year at Columbia, he was at Baruch.
How could people not have appreciated what, even by the 70s, not appreciated the. What he had done with the modern finance.
Yeah.
I get it. And he couldn't be a more genial person to the extent I know, maybe.
Yeah, no, if he's an ass, you don't notice it right away.
Right.
of course, someone like Merton's probably pretty gruff, and he's not a really nice guy.
Good.
The impression of nice guys are pretty Republican, though.
I actually have no clue about Marcus.
Well, every time I throw Barney Frank in jail and anti. I have no sympathy with redlining.
I think he thinks about redlining as a macroeconomist, you know, as sort of, and as opposed to someone who would stop and ask yourself, there are people, there's something incumbent on society to help people who want to own homes.
But redlining is even a step.
Redlining is illegal. Is that that's
yeah, it's trying to prohibit racial discrimination where you can't easily police it on a micro level. You instead say, listen, you know, we think people are the people's virtue is more evenly distributed, so we expect to see a little more evenly distributed portfolio. Soon to be lending into some of these poor neighborhoods. You know, so that's where some of that analysis came from, that banks were, in their own risk management, sort of just looking at probably demographic factors, like I said, 80% black ground lending there.
Right, that's right. Yeah. The bank that's sitting in the black neighborhood is lending all its money somewhere else.
Well, that's a second. That's the Community Reinvestment Act, which is related to redlining, but not per se exactly the same.
I thought it was triggered by redlining or something.
Well, they are interrelated because it's the same basic progressive political forces trying to reinvest and prevent discrimination.